Welcome to Haunted History Chronicles, the podcast where we unravel the mysteries of the past, one ghostly tale at a time. I'm your host, Michelle, and I'm thrilled to be your guide on this eerie journey through the pages of history. Picture this, a realm where the supernatural intertwines with the annals of time, where the echoes of the past reverberate through haunted corridors and forgotten landscapes. That's the realm we invite you to explore with us. Each episode will unearth stories, long-buried secrets, dark folklore, tales of the macabre, and discuss parapsychology topics. From ancient legends to more recent enigmas, we're delving deep into locations and accounts all around the globe, with guests joining me along the way. But this podcast is also about building a community of curious minds like you. Join the podcast on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, to share your own ghostly encounters, theories, and historical curiosities. Feel free to share with friends and family. The links are conveniently placed in the description for easy access. So whether you're a history buff with a taste for the supernatural, or a paranormal enthusiast with a thirst for knowledge, Haunted History Chronicles is your passport to the other side. Get ready for a ride through the corridors of time, where history and the supernatural converge, because every ghost has a story, and every story has a history. And now, let's introduce today's podcast, or guest. Welcome to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. Today we embark on a journey through the mysterious realm of paranormal phenomena, guided by the esteemed Dr. Callum Cooper, a lecturer in psychology at the University of Northampton and a notable figure in the field of parapsychology. Dr. Cooper's research delves into the phenomenon of phone calls from the dead, a topic revived from the depths of obscurity by his meticulous investigation. Drawing inspiration from the seminal work of D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayliss, Dr. Cooper sheds light on the intricacies of anomalous telephone communications from departed loved ones. Through his lens, we navigate the blurred boundaries between grief, hallucination, and genuine paranormal contact, confronting the age-old question: are we truly receiving calls from the beyond? Through his unwavering dedication to scientific inquiry, and his profound insights into the human experience, Dr. Cooper illuminates the path towards understanding the unexplained. So get ready as we journey into the heart of the paranormal with Dr. Callum Cooper. Hi Callum, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Do you want to just start by giving us a little bit about your background, Callum, and who you are and why it is that, you know, you have become interested in writing some of the topics that you have?
Well, my background is quite varied. I started off with an interest in performing arts, stage and theatre, but that went hand in hand with the area in which I was growing up. And it's Nottingham, and it's notorious for boasting some of the most haunted places around, such as the Salutation Inn and the Ye Olde Trip to Jerusalem, two very well-known pubs in the city centre, but Newton Abbey, which is the former home of Lord Byron, of the Byron family, the famous poet. And frequently for trips to walk around and have a picnic, and she'd forever tell me of the stories of the dog, Bosun, that Byron owned, the White Lady and the Goblin Friar. All of those stories and personal accounts that people had written up in local heritage haunting books by Jane Peters, which he had. And I always love local books on hauntings, like the really kind of rough and ready ones that were by local writers that were laminated covers, self-done drawings, stapled together. And they fascinated me. They were in the local library when I was growing up. We'd do school trips once a week to the library where we would walk down, get out a few books, use the internet as it was starting to develop, and then go back to school. But there was just this one section where I gathered with the other guys in my class. And there's probably about five or six books on 14 phenomena. So everything from Bigfoot to UFOs, the Osborne Book of Ghosts, and a few other books on ghosts and hauntings. So this always fascinated me, that when you read these particular books, they were taking the topic very seriously. And people seemed to be very honest and sincere about the accounts that they were having. So this was always my side interest, that people had these experiences. I certainly loved the film Ghostbusters and things like that growing up. But I fell in love with the serious nature of things and going to places where people claim that they'd had these fantastic experiences. So as I was making my choices of what to do in life, I was still pursuing acting, but I thought take on a psychology degree because I could fall back on it. I could use a psychology degree for a multitude of things. It might even serve me well in acting. But I ended up picking out universities that were doing third year module options. So when you do a degree, you can pick a number of different modules that make up that whole degree topic. So you could pick one of your topics in the third year, which was parapsychology. And I picked the University of Northampton. I looked at Liverpool Hope University that had a good base for parapsychology at the time, Coventry, Hertfordshire. But it was the University of Northampton where I ended up. And that's where I grew in academia to be a psychologist and specializing in a number of wonderful things, sexual behavior, death, dying, and bereavement, positive psychology, and now module coordinator of that very module and supervising doctoral candidates in their own research degrees, so PhDs and other similar doctorates that have a focus on parapsychology. So that's what got me into this area, and that's also what got me writing books and research papers on various fascinating topics about strange experiences.
And I think it's a dynamic that you bring that is, it is fantastic, because you bring rigor, you bring analysis, you bring context, but you're also bringing, I suppose, you in the other hat as well, you know, these other things that you do when it comes to psychology. You're able to bring all of those experiences together to really go in depth and discuss topics that sometimes don't get that scientific rigor, that don't get that real deep analysis. And in the case of some of your research and your work, topics that actually don't get much discussion comprehensively at all. And so it's fantastic what you've been doing, and it's brilliant that you're able to come across on the podcast tonight to share some of that insight about some of your research and your work.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for saying that. I think what makes a good writer is a good reader. The more and more that you read, the more you're digesting, possibly unconsciously, the various different writing styles which people present. You decide for yourself what's easy reading and what's not easy reading, what you pick up and what you put down. But at the same time, figuring out those niches, finding a topic that you realize, hang on, I haven't really seen this mentioned much elsewhere. I mean, I mentioned to you before we started this that I'm doing indexing today, and it's for the reprinted version. So not revised, I am going to work on a revised one, but simply a reprinting where I've just done a tiny bit of tidy up of my very first book, which was Telephone Calls from the Dead. And when I discovered that topic when I was an undergraduate student, because there had been a book before in 1979 by D. Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayliss, it took me a while. And following a newspaper account of someone allegedly having such experiences, that I looked into it and realized, wow, there's not a lot of material on this. So I became hungry for looking for book reviews of that original book. What did other people have to say on the topic? Because they haven't written articles, they've at least voiced their opinion on the original book. So that's new writing on it. Are there any articles lurking around? Are there any book chapters? Are there any other accounts that the original authors didn't note? And when you start to follow a paper trail like this of very specific information, you're building up A, a new database, and B, a new backlog of information on this topic, which can then constitute, if put together well, a new book. So you use that knowledge, you use that critical thinking that you've built up, you use your day-to-day experiences in whatever profession you do, and you bring all of that information together and tell the story through your words for other people. So I suppose that's what gives me a thirst for this knowledge. Sometimes finding areas that are interesting and looking at specific niches within them I certainly do when it comes to sexual behavior and death, dying, and bereavement and positive psychology. I'm not a master of all those trades, but I have my niches within them. And the same for parapsychology, really. It's a very broad topic and I've got niches within it. But when you find them, you become very thirsty for the knowledge and you end up becoming a master of it once you start searching the lengths and breadths for all that possible data and all the notes and writing that's been done on it.
And I think you mentioned something really important, which is that, you know, you can have a subject that is written about and talked about quite prolifically, and then other times not so much at all. But when you get really stuck into it and really engaged with that subject matter, you're able to add to it. You're able to add layers to it. And I think one of the really fantastic aspects of the book that you mentioned, Telephone Calls from the Dead, is this very comprehensive analysis organized by categories in terms of going right back to these very early forms of communication, electronic communication received by loved ones who have passed, all the way up to then much more modern examples via email and text, which obviously in some of that research done in the 1970s that was put into print wouldn't have been able to be part of that conversation. So it's that adding to that. And I don't know if you want to extrapolate and expand on that and that process of that analysis of all the different types of areas that fall under that category of communicating via some kind of electronic device with a loved one.
Sure. Well, when Rogo and Bayliss picked this up, they were typical psychical researchers who were dealing with all kinds of day-to-day phenomena that, as you say, are the typical and certainly well written about. Ghosts and telepathic experiences, having premonitions, sittings with mediums, testing psychics in the lab. And yet people were coming forward while Raymond Bayliss was doing formal electronic voice phenomena studies in the lab. So using soundproof boxes, reel-to-reel tapes, sitting in absolute silence and making recordings, and things would be there on playback, bangs, raps, and scratches. And as they were doing these studies, people came forward and said, "Oh, this might interest you. I've had an unusual experience on the telephone, whereby either someone answered the phone who turned out to not possibly be in at the time that the call was made, or they have allegedly received a call from someone that is known to be dead." And so in gathering 50 accounts of unusual telephone calls and running what is called a content analysis, a thematic one, so they're dealing with written script, they realized that some of these particular calls carry set characteristics. They perform in a certain way. And so they found about four different styles of these experiences. When I looked at these cases again and looked at another 50, I found that between case one and case two, it's a bit iffy. You can have types that fit between the two. So I just called them mixed calls to show that they're a mix of type one and type two. That they are pretty consistent in terms of how they play out. That could just purely be down to the technology that we're using in our own human psychology. One of the big criticisms that was made was people coming in and say, "Well, sure, you found patterns, but patterns don't mean paranormality." That's absolutely true. A pattern in any human behavior or to do with these electronic devices doesn't really mean much. It's just interesting that we can see which are the most common and which are the least and what kind of pattern are they following. It might start to lead to answers as to what is the source of this call taking place or what leads to the interpretation of it. So that's as far as they got. And certainly I got with a new analysis and finding that technology, as it advanced, people are still reporting unusual things. So I finished writing the book in 2011. And at that time, iPhones were just starting to become the popular thing. And so we really were getting into a new level of technology where using road maps and sat nav on your phone was getting pretty good through iPhones. It was fairly reliable using 3G and 4G. The internet and using that was getting fairly reliable. It'd have its ups and downs depending on signal, but more people writing emails on their phone. It was just coming in, so it was very fresh, and getting reports of unusual things on the mobile phone or text messages and voicemails, they were still in the few compared to a full-blown ring, ring, it's a telephone call, which was the case with all those original studies. They were all landline calls. And I think Rogo and Bayliss only found two instances of voicemails, so that where they were actually tape-recorded voicemails. And I picked up a few as well that were sent to me. So Yeah, it was all about routine analysis through social science analytical methods, content analysis, and that found patterns in the behavior and how these experiences are played out.
And I think it's, again, just coming back to something I said, it's that rigor, that approach, that categorizing and then analyzing to see what patterns do form. But I'm someone, obviously, that loves history. I can nerd out like the best of them. So to have this very comprehensive journey so that you can see those patterns across all of these different types of devices, you know, methods and means is so intriguing and fascinating. But like you said, to then just start to peel back some of those layers to try and understand, well, what is it that's going on here? What could be behind why someone's interpreting these as a conversation, a message from a loved one? What else could be behind what this is about? What's going on here? And so it's, again, it's just this very comprehensive journey through a conversation about a topic that I don't think, as we've mentioned, has happened very often.
No, I suppose there's a lot of books lately that have been either good historical reviews or they've been overviews of topics that we're quite familiar with, but from a different slant. I've got quite interested in niches. So telephone calls from the dead was the niche and I'm stuck with it. I think I'm known as the telephone guy because of that. But then I'll pick up archives. Like, I work closely with the Alex Tanz Foundation, and I've already published two of his previously unpublished books, but that was due to spending a lot of time reviewing manuscripts that never became books and looking in detail. And it's the same as picking up a telephone case. Oh, wow, this is new. No one knows about it. But then you interview the person that sent it you. You see if you can speak to other people that witnessed it as well. And you just take that critical approach to asking all the possible questions and filtering it through and seeing how good is what I've got left. And it's the same with a new manuscript, whether you've picked up a manuscript that has not been published or you write a new one. How critical have you been? What kind of audience is this going to interest? Why am I even going to publish it? What kind of contribution to knowledge is it making? So always thinking through what you're writing, the actions you're taking, the kind of evidence you're presenting, how you think the audience is going to perceive it. It's the same with data. Of anything that you're dealing with. So I think for anyone in any profession, having a critical mind and outset is really important. Critically think through all the pros and cons of what you're doing and what you're dealing with.
Absolutely. And I think what's really great about that is what you put across is that, you know, parapsychology, this very broad topic, as you mentioned, isn't just the study of the event itself. It's so much more than that. It's then what's happening behind that. It's that critical thinking, as you just referenced. It's that very analytical approach of, well, what goes beyond just simply looking at what's being presented. It's that deeper, much deeper dive into the subject matter and the material. And I guess with your background and your interest in things like, you know, altered states of consciousness, etc. Mm-hmm. And your understanding of death and grief and bereavement, being able to, again, to bring that into some of that research, like telephone calls from the dead, is a brilliant kind of interplay of different skills and interests that I do think have significant overlap in terms of the experiences. And again, I don't know if you want to kind of go into that a bit deeper in terms of some of the themes that came out of your research, your explanation, some of the science behind what could have been happening for some of these people experiencing this phenomena.
Well, sure, there were overlaps like that. So I do mention positive psychology and hope. And shortly after publishing Telephone Calls from the Dead, that became the basis for my first PhD. I was looking at post-death experiences, or we also call them after-death communication type experiences, and the cognition of hope. So I've been reading in a lot of books on ADCs about how these experiences, I would find the odd chapter saying hope as a healer, or hoping and coping. And even Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was well known for her research on death, dying, and bereavement, her first book in 1969 on death and dying, it had a chapter just called Hope. And I'd seen all of these mentions of it, but my rationale for my PhD was, people keep mentioning this word, but no one is defining what hope is. What does it mean to people? How is it actually playing a part? It's an emotional state. We can use it, manipulate it, play on it. But what do we mean by it? So I mentioned in Telephone Calls from the Dead a researcher in positive psychology called Snyder, who talked about hope as a cognitive function. So we have our cognitive agency. It's our flag in our mind that we plant of that is what I want, that's where I want to get to. We call that willpower as well. So it's cognitive agency or the willpower, the will to want something. But then you don't just get it. That's like saying I want to win the lottery, but you don't buy a lottery ticket. That's wishing. You want it. So you've decided what you want, you march out and you get the lottery ticket. But then it's all about the way power, and that's the thought pathway. How do I actually get to it? Well, you'd be lucky if you win the lottery on the basis of one ticket. You might have to start being consistent and strategic about it, or you're picking certain numbers, but you're still part of it and you know what to do that if the ticket doesn't win, or you do something else. And the same with anything you set a goal for in life. If it fails, then rethink the way forward. Don't give up, just sidestep left or right and start moving forward again. You've either got to climb over the wall, go around it, or go under it. You've still just got to keep moving forward, because that flag that you planted is now in the distance, but you've still got to aim for it and you've got to navigate your way through. And that's how hope works. Ultimately, when you've done that, you get your hope. So how does that fit into the context of after-death communications? Well, when someone has a telephone call from the dead, when someone senses the presence of a deceased loved one, when they dream about them, when they see an apparition of them, no matter what kind of beliefs they previously had, believer of the paranormal, absolute skeptic through to cynic, not sure, had read a bit about it, having an experience on top of whatever else they thought then starts to concrete existing beliefs or starts to rupture and shake up a bit of their worldviews. But it gives them the ideology of, wow, I cannot explain how that occurred. They could try and explain it away, but it starts to solidify things for them and says, well, you know, that is giving me some promise, some sort of, they don't necessarily say hope, but it is a form of hope in saying that, well, I've had this experience, so I need to just keep moving forward in life, setting goals, enjoying life, because ultimately, why should I be afraid of death? It's a win-neutral situation, not win-lose, it's win-neutral. Because what will happen is when I die, I'll be reunited with this person. That experience has told me that maybe there's some continuity and I'll be reunited. Or, as we think we know of the brain and consciousness, maybe it's just completely lights out. And that's not a negative, because it's just a complete not knowing. It's just a complete shutting down and absolute infinite void. You won't know about it. So how are you losing out? You'd have to be aware to know you're losing out, or actually stuck in a void for all eternity, which is not really happening. That's not what we hear about, except in some exceptional near-death experiences, but they are not actually dying. It's experiences of coming near to death. So it's a win-neutral situation. What's wrong with embracing the idea that from this experience, it's giving me a promise, a hope that I may survive and be reunited? So it instills in people some really good positive psychology. So there, within this topic of parapsychology, we have applied positive psychology. It's well-being. It's some health psychology. It's understanding the psychology of spirituality and maybe even religious beliefs further on. But it's also understanding thanatology, the science of death, dying, and bereavement, experiences that people have around the deathbed, experiences people have around a person who has just died, experiences people have around the time of bereavement, or even working in the funeral industry as well. So that's where we get various overlaps, and those are just a few examples. The Parapsychology Foundation used to do an international conference every year that always would be parapsychology and parapsychology and pharmacology, parapsychology and physics, parapsychology and anthropology, showing all these various overlaps in which parapsychology can play to different disciplines.
Oh gosh, completely agree with you. And I do think this is quite a profound overlap, because I think, you know, if you have a situation where someone has lost a loved one and they're grieving, there's all sorts of things going on at that point, during that moment of loss. They are coming to terms with their grief, which in itself is quite profound. But then come with that, you have lack of sleep. It's a very stressful situation. There's so many psychological factors that start to come into play as well. And all of that is just this perfect melting pot, this storm, isn't it? In terms of, it's not your usual state of being. And so trying to understand what's going on for that person, to understand the systems in play, the factors in play that are beyond just the event that they are experiencing, is what's contributing it to it. How does it all play into each other? How does it all kind of hold hands and create what's happening? You know, it's seeing the relationship, the interplay, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. And again, I just think it's fantastic that you've been able to kind of go into that research to the level that you have to bring that to people's understanding, because I think it's important to show that interplay, but also highlight the kind of hope that it can bring, the positives of it that it can bring, as well as the understanding behind it.
I think that comes back to the performer in me. So as much as I like doing the research and going through the paperwork, I get very geeky all over it. When you've gone through the long slog of writing a book or a paper, I like going out and giving public talks and making it digestible. And there I've got my stage, I've got my platform in which to deliver to an audience. Only the other day I was lecturing at the University of Northampton for the first time in a few months, because we've changed trimester, and I'm doing more supervision of PhDs and independent research projects than teaching undergraduates at the moment. But it was a social world class, social psychology on sex and society. And I've got to be honest, I wasn't feeling the best about delivering it. I got so many other things on my mind, and it was 4 hours of this class, 2 hours a break, and then another 2 hours. So you're doing the thing on repeat. But I really enjoyed it. The students were really, really good. They were very engaging. They're so different every year. They came up with some really good ideas. But it just became a performance, and sharing these ideas that I know about in sexual behavior research, a lot of pictorial examples and stuff like that. We had laughs, we had serious debates. We came up with new ideas. It was really good, but you've got to ooze that passion and that performance for it to pass on to people, to appreciate what topic you're dealing with or how it has overlaps, and ultimately how it impacts on people, how it actually matters. How is this generating new knowledge and actually matters? Why were you even bothering talking about it? It could be with parapsychology, for example. All too easily we may see on social media people dismissing it out of hand, saying, oh, there's no evidence for psychic phenomena, or a load of nonsense, or once you're dead, that's it. Not even considering the evidence, and then how actually, if you look at how it's presented or how we could present it, it's absolutely fascinating, as pretty much most topics are, when you actually give it the time of day to consider what you're dealing with and why, you know, it has a basis in the university, why there's a whole degree on it or some sort of course on it. It's got that place because it serves a purpose, and it's been deemed something that is generating new knowledge and will help people. Maybe not as a standalone topic, but it will certainly complement something else or even help people in their own lives.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I think it's adding to that picture, isn't it? It's adding to the conversation. And I think having that debate, having that discourse is so important, because it's what we do as human beings, you know, trying to understand what's happening around us, the world around us, the experiences around us. That's what we do. And I've never really understood why the field of parapsychology doesn't have that same, it's not deemed as favorably, shall we say, to talk about these things in the same way that other aspects get talked about and mentioned. And that baffles me, because there's nothing wrong in having lively debates and conversations on any subject matter, including death and dying and grief and the kind of phenomena that people experience and report and have been doing so for centuries. Let's talk about why that is happening as something that has just been there across the globe, in every culture around the world, for such a long time. Why ignore that? It's not the elephant in the room.
Yeah, I think unfortunately some of that just comes down to how we are as a society and how we again deliver and talk about things and label them. I mean, some paranormal phenomena, and I hate the word paranormal or supernatural, but essentially experiences that we struggle to fit within our current understanding of science, they just don't seem to fit the bill. They seem to fit outside it, or then we grapple with looking at, well, how could a conventional explanation explain it, where it looks unusual, but actually it's something else in disguise. It could be anomalistic psychology in that sense. But is it down to how people talk about them and they're actually clearly in the way they speak about them, putting them to one side as something that is taboo or unusual or a bit odd, or don't touch that, it's career damaging. You don't want, you know, to be labelled as the wacky person who deals with ghosts or psychics. So again, when I was delivering that class only earlier this week on sex and society, I was talking about one of the founders of the psychology of sex, which was Henry Havelock Ellis. Now, he was interested in psychical research to a very minor degree, and had a lot of correspondence with Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, who were both honorary members of the American and British Societies for Psychical Research. After Havelock Ellis died, his then wife, partner, Francoise Delisle, she'd had experiences of him, at least five or six encounters of his ghost, and she wrote them up in a further biography of her life with him called The Return of Havelock Ellis. So I mentioned this to the students, but I just said it so casually and sweeping, saying, and one of the final books on Havelock Ellis was to do with his widow's experience of his ghost, written up by Francoise Delisle, entitled The Return of Havelock Ellis. And I moved on to the next slide. You know, I didn't go into any detail. I didn't explain what the apparitions were about, because it wasn't a parapsychology class. It was sex and society. But one student went, whoa, whoa, whoa. What was the title of the book again? Is it a good read? I would like to read that. And I told them it's like from 1961. It's somewhere in the 60s. And I said, oh, that's great. You know, I'm really proud of you for wanting to go and find that book, because it's old now, but it is an interesting little read. And so neutralize it, because they're happening day to day. We did a paper only a few years back, two or three years back, for the British Journal of Psychiatry Open, which was another major survey on people's after-death communication experiences. We got over 1,000 people to answer the survey that takes at least 40 minutes to fill in. And it just showed how common these experiences are day to day. Even researchers, a general practitioner called Dewi Rees, he did a paper in the British Medical Journal in 1971 off the back of his medical doctorate, called The Hallucinations of Widowhood. He found that over 50% of widows and widowers have these experiences, everything from sense of presence phenomena through to apparitions. And then go back to the late 1880s with the Society for Psychical Research. They did a massive report in their proceedings called the Report on the Census of Hallucinations, where they'd sent out in postal correspondence over 17,000 questionnaires asking people about unusual experiences they had had, to which over 10,000 had reported in the positive. And there were a number of experiences, again, within that fit the bill of after-death communication experiences. So we realized that actually the majority of people have these experiences. What is unusual is the minority that seem to claim that in their entire lifetime, they can't relate to knowing who's calling on the phone when it's ringing before they pick it up, or sensing that someone's staring at them in a public place, or feeling a presence in the room when actually there's no one else there but yourself, or hearing a voice call out your name from the top of the stairs and you call back and there's no one else in the house. There's a multitude of experiences. You can't relate to a single one of those throughout your lifetime. They're very, very common, or even dreaming of something before it happened. And so again, it's neutralizing it. Neutralize it, be passionate about the topic, show the evidence and data that's out there. And it draws in other psychologists, physicists, anthropologists, sociologists, you name it, all coming in to meet a common purpose, which is to try and understand these experiences, which are as old as human documentation. The moment we started recording things properly, you can see depictions of premonitions or interactions with ghosts. They come along with human behavior. They're not to do with media hype or the latest fantastical film or TV series we're watching or a fictional book we've read. They predate all of those things. They just seem to be very natural experiences that we as humans seem to have. We even see animals having psychic type experiences from our observations, and also from what we've seen in lab studies with animals as well. So they're common, we can relate to them, but what are they? And it needs the time, which we are limited with time. It needs the people involved, and we don't have many people involved in parapsychology, and it needs the money, and there's not a lot of money there. So it's been chugging along for the last 100 years on very, very minimal effort and very, very minimal funding, nowhere near compared to westernized psychology, physics, you name it. That has had a lot of people, a lot of funding. It is non-comparable.
Which is baffling, considering it is such a normal aspect of human life to consider what happens to us once we pass away. You know, it happens to all of us. We experience loss. It's something that intrigues most people at some point in their life. They ask that question of themselves at some point or another. And yet, again, like you said, it's kind of doesn't have that same attention, the same kind of financial support, the same number of people really getting behind it to all come together to put in their collective knowledge and expertise to tackle the topic. It's such a source of real shame, to be honest, because I do think it means that things don't move forward in the same way that you see in other areas, which is so sad. It's really sad.
If you've been enraptured by the chilling tales and enigmas unveiled throughout our podcast Spectral Journey, now's your chance to become an integral part of our ghostly congregation. You see, as we delve deeper into the mysteries of the past, we need your support now more than ever. But fear not, for there are a myriad of ways you can help keep the supernatural flames burning bright. Firstly, have you ever considered treating our podcast to a virtual coffee? Picture it. A humble offering to fuel our relentless pursuit of haunted histories. Just head over to ko-fi.com/hauntedhistorychronicles and join us for a caffeine-infused seance. But that's merely the beginning of our spectral soiree. For those intrepid souls yearning for deeper communion with the paranormal, consider joining our exclusive Patreon family. From March onwards, our Patreon page will be a haven of clandestine content, with weekly podcasts and daily long and short form offerings. Yes, you heard it right. Daily doses of the supernatural. A veritable paranormal advent calendar for your soul. So why hesitate? Journey forth to patreon.com/hauntedhistorychronicles and become a patron today. But wait, the spirit of generosity lingers still. If you seek to flaunt your allegiance to the Haunted History Chronicles in more tangible ways, venture into our newly unearthed merchandise crypt. From mugs that whisper their secrets, to clothing that echoes with ghostly laughter, our shop is a sanctuary for the discerning paranormal aficionado. Just visit tpublic.com and traverse to the Haunted History Chronicles shop page to adorn yourself with our spectral regalia. Whether it's bestowing a virtual coffee, joining our spectral society on Patreon, or donning Haunted History Chronicles apparel, your support keeps the ethereal flames alight. Remember, every spectral contribution fuels our pursuit of unearthly truths, propelling us ever deeper into the realms of shadows and whispers. So heed the call, dear listeners. The links to our spectral sanctuaries await in the shadows of the podcast description notes, as well as our haunted haunts on social media. Dare to embrace the unknown, to journey deeper into the veiled corridors of history. For only together can we keep the ghostly embers glowing, illuminating the darkness with tales untold. Now, let us return to the mysteries that beckon from beyond the veil. What spectres await? What secrets lie dormant, waiting to be unearthed? Let us venture forth, for the journey into the unknown has only just begun.
I mean, you may have seen in the last few years, stop me if you haven't, but Robert Bigelow, did you hear about that, the essay competition?
Yeah, I did. I don't know if you want to explain to anybody listening, though, who won't know about it.
But sure. Yeah, I mean, these opportunities crop up now and then, and that was a very unique one. Robert Bigelow owns Skinwalker Ranch, which is very famous for UFO activity and poltergeist-type activity. And there's numerous documentaries on the Discovery Channel and channels very much like that regarding Skinwalker Ranch. But sadly, Robert, in the last 4 or 5 years or so, had suffered three significant bereavements within his family and started to recognize parapsychology and what it's been doing over the years. And he is a very rich aerospace entrepreneur, and decided to set up the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies to support research in this area, and offered a $500,000 prize for the best 25,000-word essay on evidence for life after death. So that would mean drawing on what existing data there is in books, papers, you name it. There were various remits. You either had to be invited, and I was invited to take part, or you could submit an application demonstrating that you've had at least 6 years involvement in parapsychology or similar topics to qualify as someone that could take part and produce a decent essay. And so that process took part. Then we heard that there was a second and third prize of $300,000 and $150,000. So we got through and we started writing the essay. I was part of a team of three other people already working on after-death communication experiences. So we decided to do a full overview of survival-themed topics and designated different topics to each person. So I did an overview of deathbed visions and the best evidence for survival within them. So I was really kind of rummaging through the data for the best ones there, and also haunting-type phenomena. Where hauntings had showed that some sort of personality aspect was being retained and interacted with. And other team members were working on mediumship and reincarnation and things like that. And then we were talking about critically assessing what the evidence means. We then found that they were going to do 11 runners-up of $50,000. So we thought, great, then we're definitely in with a chance. And once we submitted the essay, and we'd heard that there'd been hundreds of email essay submitted. I think 206 got through to be assessed by the judges. There was a selected panel of judges involved, some of them parapsychologists, some of them not. Then we heard that there were another maybe 11 honorable mentions as another award category came up, and they were for $20,000. So we found we got an honourable mention. It was weird when the email turned up because that category hadn't been announced. So when it said honourable mention, we were like, well, what's that? That's not even an award category. But it was, and it became one. And Professor Chris Rowe and myself were sent out to Las Vegas to Bigelow's Aerospace Institute to receive our plaque and meet with the other people there. It was Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, who hosts New Thinking Aloud. He won the $500,000 prize, mainly basing it on the various interviews he's done for New Thinking Aloud since the 1980s and also drawing on his own background in parapsychology. Second place went to Pimbam Lommel as a cardiologist, talking about near-death experiences. And one of our fellows in psychology at the University of Northampton, Leo Rookaby, he had done an essay that kind of mirrored itself on A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and the visitation from the ghosts and the morals that that story instills. So he was placing survival evidence within that domain, which was a very unique approach to it. So in terms of funding opportunities, that was absolutely massive. And now it's expanded on into what he calls the challenge. So he's asked for applications pretty much at any point for people to come forward of up to about $1 million to present an idea for a empirical study of survival of the mind beyond death. So it's got to be a study that shows that the data you are gathering within the study is demonstrating some sort of survival of someone's personality or consciousness beyond death, which is very, very difficult in terms of all the other possibilities that could be taken place for the data that you think you're getting. And also in terms of most parapsychological phenomena, because hauntings, apparitions, etc., they've come and gone. They're not something that you can stick in a lab. They are hearsay, they are past tense, but all you're left with is some testimony that you can apply eyewitness testimony techniques to, but you can't touch them. They're not tangible. They're not in the here and now. But mediumship is. And so I think that's where they've been having some good applications and good success rates. One of the initial winners was Dr. Julie Beischel of the Winbridge Institute. And she is a very, very good researcher and very knowledgeable on mediumship research. And I think she's gone through to the second round along with a few others. It had to be mediumship. It's the only way forward because it's the only thing that's live and active that you can actually play around with in the lab to get direct feedback on that. And besides electronic voice phenomena, potentially. So there's just one example of what Robert Bigelow has done as a funder. In other instances over time, it's been members of the Society for Psychical Research, British and American, that have left their estates to the society, you know, and it's left big funds to allow other projects to take place, big ones, or fund someone's position. Even the building that the American SPR had in New York City, that was donated by Chester F. Carlson, a beautiful, massive building right next to Central Park. And doing things like that has left a hub for an archive and a library and a lab space and a meeting place. So comes from donations like that or active entrepreneurs that want to get their foot in the door and get involved in a science that previously they've not been fully aware of, but they know that it's meeting some of their interests and expectations and life experiences.
And I think when you kind of talk through that, all of that, I think it's brilliant, because for me, I think part of the problem is so much of this is still not something that people necessarily know is out there. And so what does that then create? It creates people who don't know that they can go down this route of studying parapsychology. And so by having people talk about it, by having these types of institutions, making them more, you know, putting things out there for people to consume, listening to podcasts, having documentaries, people writing about topics and subjects, I think it just raises that awareness. And hopefully in inverted commas, but hopefully what that then means is that we have an expanding crop of people coming into this field. So it's no longer just a few people in isolation coming at this topic, that it's something that just grows, that because people have that interest, they realize that there is a route into it and it can be something really positive, and it's not career ending, as you mentioned earlier.
No, it really isn't now. I mean, I think that was more so a scare tactic that happened in previous years as well. I mean, I would have been so surprised, and maybe a few parapsychologists have got their individual stories, but if someone in their early career in higher education had gone on to instantly do a PhD in parapsychology and they said, well, that's it, you're not going to be able to use that for anything. Well, I think any PhD topic, if you just keep it as a standalone topic and you've not shown some interdisciplinary practice where you brought in a variety of research methods or how it links to another topic, then you really have only got one string on your bow. And if that snaps, then you're done for. It's not going to work. So there really is something important about having many strings to your bow, because it shows how you can actually adapt and apply yourself to different workplace settings or research settings as well. And so I've got two doctorates, and both of them have an involvement in parapsychology, one far more than the other. But both doctorates, you know, I could highlight at least 3, 4, 5 different topics within the thesis. It just has some sort of central, the second one has a central focus on parapsychology. The first one has a side focus on it. The main focus is positive psychology and thanatology. A PhD doesn't have to be standalone. And it's about ultimately how you apply yourself. Just because you've got a degree, well done for getting one, that doesn't mean say you deserve the job. You really don't. Apply yourself. Show how you are good at what you do, you're passionate, you're willing to get stuck in with whatever you do, but how the degree has helped you, not how the degree is helping you and it will get you the job. You are the person in front of the degree, not the other way around. And so you've got to apply yourself. It doesn't matter what topic it's in. You hear about people doing PhDs in the history of beer mats or David Beckham or Harry Potter or whatever else. I even hear golf course management, but there's a lot of money in golf. So I can't see that a PhD in golf or golf course management is necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, go where the money goes. Someone will want you for that expertise. So again, it's all about how you apply yourself.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's about having those different strings and kind of manipulating them and using them. And again, having that interplay between all the different areas that you have, that you can draw upon, and getting ahead of it and really thinking about how these things connect to really start driving some of the conversation and some of the material in terms of the conversations around it, add to it, bring in that expertise that again just keeps that momentum and that interest and that movement in just trying to drive some of that material forward is so key and so crucial. And I suppose a question to ask you in some of the research that you have done, which is very extensive, obviously, is have there been areas of real particular interest for you that when you've got into it that have just been really compelling in terms of some of the material that's come out, the insight that you've been able to bring or add to that, that has just been the moments that have really just been so satisfying for you as in terms of what you do?
It's a really interesting question with probably a very odd and surprisingly dull answer, because I had, I don't know if it was being interviewed for a TV pilot or whether it was another podcast one time. I think it was more a TV pilot because they were trying to sculpt how they wanted the show to play out. And they kept saying, if you could have the ideal paranormal case or the ideal haunted location, what would it be or where would it be? You know, what would you want to know about or hear about? And I said, well, nothing really. And they said, oh, come on, this is what you do for a living. And I said, yeah, but because I do it for a living, I hear about several classical or new cases every day. I'm surrounded right now in this room alone by several thousand books that relate to various experiences. I'm forever diving into them. I've been spending all day working on an index for the telephone calls from the dead. I've sort of neutralized these experiences to me. I hear about them all the time. I can't necessarily say that I have got one case on my hand that there is no other explanation whatsoever unless it's just from the dead or it's some sort of unusual psychic process is taking place. Of course not. That's not my mentality. That's not how I think. But I don't jump up and down and say, oh my God, this is really weird. This is really weird. What have we got going on here? I am that kind of typical psychologist that is dealing with them day by day and trying to understand them. And I sympathize with people that have these experiences. And I'm interested in listening to the experience, but I don't jump up and down about it. They certainly fascinate me to keep me in the profession that I'm in. But they don't tickle and tantalize me like a group of friends having a dinner party that then start talking about ghost experiences and they get really excited and talk about, oh, I would love to experience this or I'd love to experience that. I don't get to that level anymore. Maybe I was at one point, but now I just feel so neutralized by it because I'm living and breathing it every day. It sounds like probably a really deflated answer, but that is kind of the situation that I'm in, really. And to some producers and stuff, they get really annoyed because they're asking me to literally put on a play what they could film. When actually I'm asking them, no, what would you like to see? What would you like to see? And then put me in the environment, because then you'll get how I deal with it and explain it, which is that's the gold nugget.
But honestly, I think that's actually the perfect answer, because what you're saying is it's that normalizing the conversation and all those different touching points that you have in the field of parapsychology. And we don't want to be jumping around and dancing around about it. We want it to be something logical and rational and a discourse. And so, yeah, I think it's finding the interest and the intrigue and what it is that you can learn from any experience, however big and however small. What is it that you can uncover from that experience? What does it tell you? What's it showing you? What's it helping you to understand? And I think that's actually the perfect answer, because okay. I think it then applies to anything that you do. I mean, I have the same with the podcast, where because I go from various different topics with various different guests, and each one of the conversations I have is intriguing for exactly that same reason. Mm. I find the breadth is what is interesting. I find the discussion behind what it is that they're trying to tell me, the bit that's interesting. Probably the same kind of experience, but just obviously different being a podcaster.
It's probably like asking a dominatrix or someone that works in a sex shop, what's your favorite sexual fantasy, or someone that works in a chocolate shop, what's your favorite chocolate? I'm dealing with this every day. You know, I appreciate it. That's why I'm in the job. But, you know, I'm interested in other things that would really, you know, give me the wow factor. This stuff, I'm just dealing with it and I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's the normal part of what you're doing, isn't it? It's not the unusual part. And I think that's the misconception. For most people who come to this, the paranormal is weird. It's something strange. It's not something normal. But when you are immersed in the world, it is in that field and in that world, it is profoundly normal because you're having those conversations routinely. And so, yeah, it kind of, in some ways, demystifies some of what other people perceive it to be, if that makes sense.
No, I totally agree. It's I think I've just naturally become neutralized them. I mean, I deal with parapsychology the most. So when I was doing, I keep bringing it up as an example, but that Sex and Society, and I've done that class a few times. But there's always plot twists and spins with that, because I'm dealing with a class that start to mention their own experiences or things that they've seen on TV and things like that, or things they've read about. So it's throwing me curveballs all the time. So in a territory that's forever changing, you know, labels on sexuality and what is and isn't acceptable to be played on the TV, from embarrassing bodies through to naked attraction and all things that are trying to get the audience to have an unusual reaction to something that they think, well, this was previously unacceptable, but now we're going to put this in front of you. When it comes to unusual experiences, I've just spent so much of my life dealing with it and reading about it. Yeah, I think it's probably helped a lot the audiences that I come into contact with, whether it be someone that needs help or just a member of the public that comes along to one of my talks and wants to wait around at the end just to tell me their experiences, because they know absolutely it is not going to get shut down or mocked. And, you know, I'll be thankful of the fact that they felt like they could share it with me. And in other areas of psychology as well, when it comes to personal loss or sexual behavior or whatever else, sometimes people just want the moment to just talk to me for a bit. I'm not a counselor, but they know that I'm in a position of understanding and empathy. And of course I'll listen. Of course I'll take the time.
And I think that's part of the, you know, ethical consideration that needs to be involved in any aspect of dealing with people, but around these kinds of topics, I think very much needed, that sometimes doesn't happen. And I do think it's an important part of this that needs to be kind of made note of, and really kind of the fact that you mentioned it, I think, is significant, because like I said, I just think it's important that people note that. We've got to remember that people having these experiences, it's an experience for them, and sometimes they just need to be heard rather than dismissed. There's nothing worse than feeling shut down, especially, I think, if it's around topics of loss and grief and an experience around having lost someone, to then have that just pushed to the side is devastating. And I would imagine could have quite deep, you know, quite a deep psychological impact on someone if they have felt they've had something quite profound happen to them that is just mocked, like you mentioned.
I've always taken a particular stance on that whenever I'm in a public setting, and people might ask me about strange experiences they've had around the home or to do with a haunting or a premonition. They'll say, explain that. And number one, I can't really, because I wasn't there. You're telling me something either shortly after it's happened or a long time after it's happened. I've got your rendition of the events, so I could give you my thoughts on it as to what the alternative might be and what might be a conventional explanation, because that's what you've asked for. But when someone says, oh, my granddad died, and then they'll say, so what do you think about that? And I say, well, do you really want me to explain it away with what I think was actually going on? I'm not going to do that. You've taken the time to tell me that your granddad died, and then you've had this wonderful experience. What on earth is that really going to contribute to if I tell you what I think was going on that certainly was not your dead granddad? Nothing. So, you know, all I can say to you is these experiences are extremely common. What you just mentioned is very relatable to all the experiences that people have had. They are very good for your coping styles and moving forward in life. It's good for your health and well-being. And I'd be interested to know more about how you've incorporated that into your worldview moving forward. But why on earth would I shatter your experience for you? Why are you asking me to do that? I don't think you're really thinking about the consequences of what you're asking me. I'm taking something away from you that's very personal and precious, and you don't know whether it's going to happen again or whether it was just a one-off. So this is different. This is personable when you're talking about loss. So no, if you're telling me about, you know, you left the room and you came back and a spoon was suddenly bent on the dining room table and no one was in the room, you haven't suffered a loss, sure, I'll try and put my mind to that. But when you're telling me that a loved one has passed away and you had an experience with them, I don't want to destroy that scenario for you or any other family member. I don't think you're thinking through the consequences of asking me that question.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Honestly, it's just been so fantastic to talk to you. And I suppose just to help wrap things up, I don't know if there's anything that you're particularly looking forward to looking at in the future, anything that's coming up, areas of interest that you're really diving into that you would like to share with the people listening so they can look out for more of that from you in the future.
Oh, they are numerous. And I'm really trying to pull my socks up and I feel like I'm fighting against the... the tide of just life at the moment, but I'm still battling forward. I've got so much hope and inspiration and positive psychology. I'll keep battling on. But Telephone Calls from the Dead was out of print for at least the last 6 or 7 years. And it's my most in-demand book, even though it was a small private publication at the time. So within this next week or so, it should be out. I'm literally now just finishing up on final tidy points of the index, and it's just to bring out a second printing. So only some minor corrections have been made just to keep it out there so it doesn't go out of print again. It'll be print on demand on Amazon and Kindle. So look at my Amazon author page, save it, and you should see it suddenly pop up as a new book in terms of a new ISBN. I have the same cover as the original that's still on there, but a different back to it. So that's Telephone Calls from the Dead. I've got different books on there, such as Psy Wars. I did the foreword for that with Craig Wheeler. I did Paracoustics as an editor book with Steve Parsons, and we are steadily working on the second part of that, which is Paravision. He's way ahead of me on that already. And then I'm doing various projects as well with my PhD candidates. We're looking at diet and psychic experiences. We're looking at flotation tanks and altered states of consciousness. We're looking at psi experiences, so psychic experiences within the funeral industry. They're all going to come out bit by bit. You'll see them as presentations at the Society for Psychical Research and other places. I will keep everyone posted on my Facebook and Twitter page if you want to know about those. And then my media appearances keep on coming up all the time, which again, I keep people abreast of on mainly my Twitter page for stuff like that. I'd done Uncanny before, for example, with Danny Robbins. I should be catching up with him again soon and seeing whether I'm involved in any more of those going forward. But surprisingly, a lot of people have remembered me being involved in one of the episodes called An Angel Called Bernie. I'm surprised just being in one. It shows how much of a following there is for Uncanny that people have remembered that I was in that. Paranormal Captured as well. I don't know if that's going to go ahead for a third series, but I did the Christmas special and second series to that. There's all sorts of different things in the pipeline. So we'll see what comes up, and just follow my social media or go on my website, which is callumecooper.com, to see what's going on.
And I will make sure to include all of those links and details and, you know, links to your Amazon page, etc., on the website and in the podcast description notes, etc., just so that people are really easily signposted to you and to your work. Because gosh, the things that you're contributing to the material out there and the discussion out there and the amount of public appearances that you give and, you know, time that you give to talking about this with the public is just absolutely amazing, and a real credit to your passion and your commitment to this as a field and as a discussion and as something of interest. So yeah, I hope if anybody hasn't heard you or seen more of you or read some of your work that they do, because I mean the Stephen Parsons books, the Paracoustics book, is on my shelf. It's one of my favorite books. It's a brilliant read, and I was only talking about it with someone recently actually, that, you know, it's not a heavy material book. It's not one of those ones that if you open it, it's going to take you 10 years to read, if that makes sense. It's really, really well structured and fantastic at just getting across really important information in a really simple and easy format, but so incredibly useful. It's something that anybody in the field really should have in their library.
It's like a ghost hunter's kind of guidebook to keep in that equipment case or on your shelf. It goes hand in hand with his book Ghostology, but when it comes to Paracoustics and Paravision, which is coming out, as you've seen, they're edited anthologies. It's not a page, you can read it page by page and chapter by chapter if you want, but I wouldn't recommend it. I'd recommend when you get that book or Paravision when it comes out, you look at the chapter index at the start, look at the content page, and go straight to the chapter that interests you the most. Yep. And read it and tick it off the list. Work your way around the chapters. They don't follow any storyline. It's not a kind of a page turner and one chapter leads to the next. It doesn't. That we've just set them in an order that seems that, well, they group together well, but they don't lead into each other. So pick the chapters that you like and you enjoy.
And go with those that are something of relevance to you right now, whether it's something that's interesting you, or if it's something that you're coming across that you want to know and find out more. And for anyone that is interested in, you know, parapsychology, how to, you know, just on a very basic level, trying to understand some of the phenomena and how to best utilize some of the tools, et cetera, that are out there and understand what's, you know, what could be happening. Again, just like you said, it's almost a guidebook that should just be handed out to anybody that's interested in the field. It's brilliant.
That's
really good.
That's good to hear.
So like I said, I'm going to make sure that all of those links are so easily accessible so that people can find them, because I highly recommend them. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, if people have listened today, that if this is an area that they're interested in, that they're going to want to have access to your new book when it comes out shortly, or the revised version of it at least.
Yeah, second printing, and then there will be a revised one in the next couple of years. It will be another title. I'll be doing a lot of rewriting of chapters, and there'll be another 4 or 5 chapters to it. So it'd be like a sequel to what I've done, but I just wanted to preserve this original format. So it's another printing.
Oh, I can't wait for that one. And honestly, anything that you do in the future on altered states of consciousness, I just think that's so fascinating and how that can play in. I mean, one of the things that always fascinates me is medical conditions that could have that same impact. You know, someone maybe who has epilepsy, for example, how does that kind of play into experiences? I'm a migraine sufferer, but, you know, I can get really chronic migraines. And there are parts of my brain that fire very differently before, during and after a migraine attack, as well as then all the things that you can experience, you know, in terms of visual, auditory sensations. And so that crossover I find fascinating. And the number of people that I talk to who have particular conditions, whether it is just migraines, whether it is something like epilepsy, how they can be really sensitive to some things. And 9 times out of 10, they're people that come forward and say, you know, I've had this experience. And begs that question, is there some connection and correlation between what they're experiencing and also some of the conditions that they have? It's just, yeah, it's always there in the back of my brain as well as something that interests me.
Well, it's been written about. Vernon Nepi, he'd written about temporal lobe epilepsy in the South African Journal of Parapsychology. One of our own in-house psychologists, Dr. Louise Spires, her whole PhD was on spiritual experiences and temporal lobe epilepsy, because she has temporal lobe epilepsy herself. So it was an autoethnographic approach, talking about her experiences and what research has found, and the ancient text through to modern writing. So that interest and the writing and the research is there, it's out there. But that's a topic for another day.
Absolutely. Honestly, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Likewise, it's lovely to hear your voice, Michelle, and thank you for all the questions and your time too.
And I'll say goodbye to everybody listening. Bye, everybody.